Chapter 4. Wines are absurd. The light sherry at 26s. The champagne at 42s. And you are not to go beyond 36s. For the claret, and port after dinner. Mind, coffee will be served. And you come upstairs after two rounds of the claret. Of course, acquiesced the wretch, and hurried out of the house to his chambers, and to discharge the commissions with which the womankind had interested him. As for Mrs. Gashley, you might have heard her bawling over the house the whole day long. That admirable woman was everywhere. In the kitchen until the arrival of Truncheon, before whom she would not retreat without a battle, on the stairs, in Fitzroy's dressing room, and in Fitzroy Minor's nursery, to whom she gave a dose of her own composition, while the nurse was sent out on a pretext, to make purchases of garnish for the dishes, to be served for the little dinner. Garnish for the dishes. As if the folks at Fubsby's could not garnish dishes better than Gashley, with her stupid old world devices of laurel leaves, parsley, and cut turnips. Why, there was not a dish served that day that was not covered over with skewers, on which truffles, crayfish, mushrooms, and forced meat were impaled. When old Gashley went down with her barbarian bunches of holly and greens, to stick about the meats, even the cook saw their incongruity, and, at Truncheon's orders, flung the whole shrubbery into the dust house, where, while poking about the premises, you may be sure Mrs. G. saw it. Every candle which was to be burned that night, including the tallow candle, which she said was a good enough bed light for Fitzroy, she stuck into the candlesticks with her own hands, giving her own high-shouldered plated candlesticks of the year 1798 the place of honor. She upset all poor Rosa's floral arrangements, turning the nosegays from one vase into the other without any pity, and was never tired of beating, and pushing, and patting, and whapping the curtain and sofa draperies into shape in the little drawing room. In Fitz's own apartments she reveled with peculiar pleasure. It has been described how as he had sacked his study and pushed away his papers, some of which, including three cigars, and the commencement of an article for the Law Magazine, Lives of the Sheriff's Officers, he has never been able to find to this day. Mama now went into the little room in the back regions, which is Fitz's dressing room, and was destined to be a cloak room, and here she rummaged to her heart's delight. In an incredibly short space of time she examined all his outlying pockets, drawers, and letters. She inspected his socks and handkerchiefs in the top drawers, and on the dressing table, his razors, shaving strop, and hair oil. She carried off his silver top scent bottle out of his dressing case, and a half dozen of his favorite pills which Fitz possesses in common with every well-regulated man, and probably administered them to her own family. His boots, glossy pumps, and slippers she pushed into the shower bath, where the poor fellow stepped into them the next morning, in the midst of a pool in which they were lying. The baby was found sucking his boot hooks the next day in the nursery. And as for the bottle of varnish for his shoes, which he generally paints upon the trees himself, having a pretty taste in that way, it could never be found to the present hour, but it was remarked that the young Master Gashleys, when they came home for the holidays, always wore lacquered high-lows, and the reader may draw his conclusions from that fact. In the course of the day all the servants gave Mrs. Timmons warning. The cook said she couldn't bear it no longer, aving Mrs. G. always about her kitchen, with her fingers in all the saucepans. Mrs. G. had got her the place, but she preferred one as Mrs. G. didn't get for her. The nurse said she was come to nuss Master Fitzroy, and knew her duty. His grandmama wasn't his nuss, and was always aggravating her. Miss Suss must shoot herself elsewhere. The housemaid gave utterance to the same sentiments in language more violent. Little Buttons bounced up to his mistress, said he was butler of the family, Mrs. G. was always poking about his pantry, and damn if he'd stand it. At every moment Rosa grew more and more bewildered. The baby howled a great deal during the day. His large china christening bowl was cracked by Mrs. Gashley altering the flowers in it, and pretending to be very cool, whilst her hands shook with rage. "Pray go on, Mama," Rosa said with tears in her eyes. "Hold you like to break the chandelier?" "Ungrateful, unnatural child," bellowed the other. "Lie that I know you couldn't do without me, I'd leave the house this minute." "As you wish," said Rosa, but Mrs. G didn't wish. And in this juncture Truncheon arrived. That officer surveyed the dining room, laid the cloth there with admirable precision and neatness, ranged the plate on the sideboard with graceful accuracy, but objected to that old thing in the center, as he called Mrs. Gashley's silver basket, as cumbrous and useless for the table, where they would want all the room they could get. Order was not restored to the house, nor, indeed, any decent progress made, until this great man came. But where there was a revolt before, and a general disposition to strike work, and to yell out defiance against Mrs. Gashley, who was sitting bewildered and furious in the drawing room, where there was before commotion, at the appearance of the master spirit, all was peace and unanimity. The cook went back to her pans, the housemaid busied herself with the china and glass, cleaning some articles and breaking others. Buttons sprang up and down the stairs, obedient to the orders of his chief, and all things went well, and in their season. At 6, the man with the wine came from Binny and Latham's. At 6:15, Timmons himself arrived. At 6:30 he might have been heard shouting out for his varnished boots, but we know where those had been hidden, and for his dressing things, but Mrs. Gashley had put them away. As in his vain inquiries for these articles he stood shouting, "Nurse! Buttons! Rosa, my dear!" and the most fearful execrations up and down the stairs, Mr. Truncheon came out on him. "Excuse me, sir," says he, "but it's impossible. We can't dine 20 at that table, not if you set 'em out a winder, we can't." "What's to be done?" asked Fitzroy, in an agony. "They've all said they'd come." "Can't do it," said the other. "With two top and bottom and your table is as narrow as a bench, we can't hold more than 18, and then each person's elbows will be into his neighbor's chair." "Rosa! Mrs. Gashley!" cried out Timmons. "Come down and speak to this gentleman, Truncheon, sir," said the man. The women descended from the drawing room. "Look and see, ladies," he said, inducting them into the dining room, "there's the room, there's the table 8 for 18, and I defy you to squeeze in more." "One person in a party always fails," said Mrs. Gashley, getting alarmed. "That's 19, Mr. Truncheon remarked. "He must knock another off, ma'am." And he looked her hard in the face. Mrs. Gashley was very red and nervous, and paced, or rather squeezed round the table. It was as much as she could do. The chairs could not be put any closer than they were. It was impossible, unless the convive sat as a centerpiece in the middle, to put another guest at that table. "Look at that lady moving round, sir. You see now the difficulty. If my men wasn't thinner, they couldn't operate at all," Mr. Truncheon observed, who seemed to have a spite to Mrs. Gashley. "What is to be done?" she said, with purple accents. "My dearest mama," Rosa cried out, "you must stop at home, how sorry I am." And she shot one glance at Fitzroy, who shot another at the great Truncheon, who held down his eyes. "He could manage with 18, he said, mildly. Mrs. Gashley gave a hideous laugh. ... She went away. At 8 o'clock she was pacing at the corner of the street, and actually saw the company arrive. First came the Topham Sawyers, in their light blue carriage with the white hammer cloth, and blue and white ribbons. Their footman drove the house down with the knocking. Then followed the ponderous and snuff-colored vehicle, with faded gilt wheels and brass earl's coronets all over it, the conveyance of the House of Bungay. The Countess of Bungay and daughter stepped out of the carriage. The 14th Earl of Bungay couldn't come. Sir Thomas and Lady Gulpin's fly made its appearance, from which issued the General with his star, and Lady Gulpin in yellow satin. The rowdy's brougham followed next, after which Mrs. Butt's handsome equipage drove up. The two friends of the house, young gentlemen from the Temple, now arrived in cab No. 9996. We tossed up, in fact, which should pay the fare. Mr. Ranville walked, and was dusting his boots as the Templars drove up. Lord Castlemouldy came out of a twopenny omnibus. Funnyman, the wag, came last, whirling up rapidly in a hansom, just as Mrs. Gashley, with rage in her heart, was counting that two people had failed, and that there were only 17 after all. Mr. Truncheon passed our names to Mr. Billiter, who bawled them out on the stairs. Rosa was smiling in a pink dress, and looking as fresh as an angel, and received her company with that grace which has always characterized her. The moment of the dinner arrived, old Lady Bungay scuffled off on the arm of Fitzroy, while the rear was brought up by Rosa and Lord Castlemouldy, of Balish and Vanvitt Castle, Co., Tipperary. Some fellows who had the luck took down ladies to dinner. I was not sorry to be out of the way of Mrs. Rowdy, with her dandified airs, or of that high and mighty county princess, Mrs. Topham Sawyer. Vi. Of course it does not become the present writer, who has partaken of the best entertainment which his friends could supply, to make fun of their somewhat ostentatious, as it must be confessed, hospitality. If they gave a dinner beyond their means, it is no business of mine. I hate a man who goes, and eats a friend's meat, and then blabs the secrets of the mahogany. Such a man deserves never to be asked to dinner again. And though at the close of a London season, that seems no great loss, and you sicken of a whitebait as you would of a whale, yet we must always remember that there's another season coming, and hold our tongues for the present. As for describing, then, the mere victuals on Timon's table, that would be absurd. Everybody, I mean of the genteel world of course, of which I make no doubt the reader is a polite ornament, everybody has the same everything in London. You see the same coats, the same dinners, the same boiled fowls and mutton, the same cutlets, fish, and cucumbers, the same lumps of Wenham Lake ice, and sea. The waiters with white neckcloths are as like each other everywhere as the peas which they hand round with the ducks of the second course. Can't anyone invent anything new? The only difference between Timon's dinner and his neighbor's was, that he had hired, as we have said, the greater part of the plate, and that his cowardly conscience magnified faults and disasters, of which no one else probably took heed. But Rosa thought, from the supercilious air with which Mrs. Topham Sawyer was eyeing the plate and other arrangements, that she was remarking the difference of the ciphers on the forks and spoons which had, in fact, been borrowed from every one of Fitzroy's friends. I know, for instance, that he had my six, among others, and only returned five, along with a battered old black-pronged plated abomination, which I have no doubt belongs to Mrs. Gashley, whom I hereby request to send back mine in exchange. Their guilty consciences, I say, made them fancy that everyone was spying out their domestic deficiencies. Whereas, it is probable that nobody present thought of their failings at all. People never do. They never see holes in their neighbor's coats. They are too indolent, simple, and charitable. Some things, however, one could not help remarking. For instance, though Fitz is my closest friend, yet could I avoid seeing, and being amused by his perplexity, and his dismal efforts to be facetious? His eye wandered all round the little room with quick uneasy glances, very different from those frank and jovial looks with which he is accustomed to welcome you to a leg of mutton. And Rosa, from the other end of the table, and over the flowers, entree dishes, and wine coolers, telegraphed him with signals of corresponding alarm. Poor devils, why did they ever go beyond that leg of mutton? Funnyman was not brilliant in conversation, scarcely opening his mouth, except for the purposes of feasting. The fact is, our friend Tom Dawson was at table, who knew all his stories, and in his presence the greatest wag is always silent and uneasy. Fitz has a very pretty wit of his own, and a good reputation on circuit, but he is timid before great people. And indeed the presence of that awful Lady Bungay on his right hand was enough to damp him. She was in court mourning for the late Prince of Schlippenschloppen, as he had on a large black funereal turban and appurtenances, and a vast breastplate of twinkling, twiddling black bugles. No wonder a man could not be gay in talking to her. Mrs. Rowdy and Mrs. Topham Sawyer love each other as women do who of the same receiving knights, and ask the same society. They were only separated by Ranville, who tries to be well with both, and they talked at each other across him. Topham and Rowdy growled out a conversation about Rum Ireland, and the navigation laws, quite unfit for print. Sawyer never speaks three words without mentioning the house and the speaker. The Irish peer said nothing, which was a comfort, but he ate and drank of everything which came in his way, and cut his usual absurd figure in dyed whiskers and a yellow underwaistcoat. General Gulpin sported his star, and looked fat and florid, but melancholy. His wife ordered away his dinner, just like honest Sancho's physician at Barataria. Botherby's stories about Lamartine are as old as the hills, since the barricades of 1848, and he could not get in a word or Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.